ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
A federal judge extends a pause on the Trump administration's resignation offer to government workers.
The hearing came nearly 2 weeks after an email landed in federal employee inboxes, subject line, fork in the road.
For Monday, February 10th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, President Trump calls for tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports.
Any steel coming into the United States is going to have a 25% tariff,
which could help domestic producers.
And which could also raise prices for U.S. businesses and consumers.
Also, Nigeria is Africa's most populous country.
It's also a major hub for the skin whitening industry. Now the government is sounding a new warning about the dangers.
People that bleach their skin is like an addiction.
Those stories and lots more after today's news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump signed new proclamations today placing tariffs on steel and aluminum. NPR's Deepa Chevron reports the moves have the potential to bolster domestic steel and aluminum makers, but could also raise costs for businesses and consumers.
The proclamations reimpose a 25% tariff on steel imports on all countries. It ends a Biden-era exclusion for certain favored nations. Trump also raised aluminum tariffs from 10 to 25%. The proclamations create new requirements for steel and aluminum in North America. The goal is to prevent countries like China and Russia from sending their steel to Mexico and Canada, where it then gets relabeled before being sent to the U.S. in order to avoid tariffs. In his first term, Trump also put tariffs on steel and aluminum, which caused global backlash. The president claims that those tariffs saved the steel and aluminum industries. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, the White House.
After they were notified over the weekend to work from home, employees of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau say they're worried they could suffer the same fate as other federal agencies. President Trump's budget chief sent an email to CFPB workers informing them the agency's D.C. headquarters is closed. It's the latest turn in a tumultuous few days at the Bureau, where staff have been told by new acting director Russell Vogt to cease essentially all the Bureau's work. Vogt also posted on social media he's not requesting the Bureau's next round of funding from the Federal Reserve. A federal judge in Massachusetts has temporarily blocked a new Trump administration policy that would cap how much the National Institutes of Health pays for indirect costs of medical research. Here's NPR's Rob Stein.
Attorneys general representing 22 states have asked the judge to block the new policy, arguing that it's illegal. The NIH announced late Friday that the agency was capping the rate at which the agency would pay for indirect costs at 15%. That's far less than the NIH had been paying and would result in the loss of billions of dollars to universities, medical schools, research hospitals, and other institutions. Indirect costs include building maintenance, electricity bills, and other overhead expenses. A judge has now issued a temporary restraining order, putting the cap on hold pending a hearing later this month. Rob Stein, NPR News.
It's an offer that was reportedly quickly rejected, a $97.4 billion offer from Elon Musk and a group of investors to buy the artificial intelligence company OpenAI, the parent of ChatGPT. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman in a post on Musk's social media platform X saying, quote, "No thank you, but we'll buy Twitter for $9.74 billion if you want." A not-so-subtle jab at the billionaire who purchased Twitter, renamed X, for $44 billion in 2022. Musk has his own AI startup company called XAI. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street today, the Dow up 167 points. This is NPR. President Trump has announced today he plans to pardon former Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich. That's according to a person familiar with his plans, not authorized to speak publicly. Trump commuted the former governor's 14-year corruption sentence during his first term. Trump was expected to sign the pardon today. Blagojevich was convicted in 2011 on charges that included seeking to sell an appointment to then-President Barack Obama's old Senate seat. J.D. Vance is stepping into the world stage this week as U.S. Vice President in a high-stakes AI summit in Paris. More from NPR's Eleanor Beardsley.
French President Emmanuel Macron is holding the summit in Paris along with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. France and India want to show there is more than just the U.S. and China when it comes to artificial intelligence. The summit has drawn world leaders, top tech executives, and policymakers to discuss AI's impact on global security, economics, and governance. Macron called on attendees to choose Europe for their business, announcing 109 billion euros of investments in AI for his country. The technology uses an enormous amount of energy, and France is attractive because of its non-carbon nuclear power. Vice President Vance is set to speak to attendees on Tuesday. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Arizona says it's adding a new species of bat to the night creatures visiting the state. The recent confirmation of the return of the Mexican long-nosed bat, in part confirmed with the help of residents there. In the past, a bat would have had to be captured, but researchers tested the bird feeders of hummingbird feeders for saliva of the bats. The Mexican long-nosed bat has been listed as endangered. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The resignation offer to federal employees known as Fork in the Road is on hold again. In a hearing today, labor unions representing 800,000 federal workers argued that the offer is unlawful, confusing, and rushed. The Trump administration defended it as humane. A federal judge extended a pause that he ordered last week while he decides what to do. NPR's Andrea Hsu is covering all of this and joins us now. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey. Okay, so before we get to what happened in court, let's just make sure that everyone understands what this quote-unquote fork in the road is. What exactly is the offer on the table here?
Yeah, well, it's been almost 2 weeks since the Trump administration first sent out this email that offered nearly all federal workers the option to resign in exchange for pay and benefits through the end of September. And the original deadline to accept this offer was last Thursday, but then unions representing federal workers sued and called the offer unlawful and as well as arbitrary and capricious. And last Thursday, a federal judge in Boston, George O'Toole, pushed the deadline back to today so he could hear arguments in the case.
Okay, so what happened in court today?
Well, the hearing lasted about an hour, and the attorney representing the unions, Elena Goldstein, told the judge, we need a temporary restraining order because employees are suffering. You know, the unions have repeatedly cited the chaos and confusion that federal workers have faced. They've gotten conflicting information about what exactly they're agreeing to if they take the resignation offer. And today Goldstein said it's as if the Office of Personnel Management was making it up as it went along. She said irreparable harm will continue if the court doesn't further pause what she called an exploding deadline. And our colleague Walter Westman from our member station WBUR was in the courtroom today, and he said Goldstein spoke for about 30 minutes with almost no interruptions or even questions from the judge.
Okay, that was the union side, but what did the federal government have to say?
Well, the attorney representing the government was Eric Hamilton, and he called the offer a humane off-ramp for federal workers who may not be so happy with all the changes that the Trump administration is bringing in. Because as you know, President Trump, guided by his advisor Elon Musk and his government efficiency team, they've already begun slashing staff and shutting down offices, forcing everyone back into the office, including people who had been remote for years. And Hamilton said rather than deal with all this uncertainty, federal workers can resign with pay and wind down their work. But Elsa, one hang-up has been that Congress appropriated money for most agencies only until the middle of March. But today, Hamilton made the argument that the administration doesn't need congressional approval for this offer. He said, you know, this offer is not a change to the government's funding obligations because federal workers who resign would still be getting their regular pay and benefits, nothing more. And he questioned whether the unions even had standing to bring this case.
Well, did the judge offer any clue of which way he was leaning?
The judge really said very little today, but right after the hearing, Elena Goldstein, the attorney for the labor unions, spoke to reporters outside and announced that the judge had extended the pause he issued last week, and here's what else she had to say.
We hope that this decision today will provide civil service workers with the assurance that the American people have their backs, and we will continue to pursue all legal options to ensure that they are protected and that the law is upheld.
And a short while later, the court clerk entered a note into the docket that said the current stay of the deadline will remain in effect until further order of the court. So we don't know when the judge might rule. Now, President Trump did answer a question about the pause this evening. He said he was confident the administration would prevail. He said he got elected on making government better and more efficient and smaller, and that's what he's doing. And he added that he thought it was a very generous offer.
That is NPR's Andrea Hsu. Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you.
President Trump has ordered steep tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. That extends a trade battle that Trump launched the first time he was in the White House. The president shared his idea over the weekend with reporters traveling aboard Air Force One.
Any steel coming into the United States is going to have a 25% tariff.
Steel, and Trump wants to do the same thing with imported aluminum. So how has this idea been received by businesses that use steel and aluminum? And how might it impact your prices at the grocery store? For help answering, we are joined by NPR's Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Scott, I think you and I have seen this movie before. I mentioned this is tracks what we saw in the first Trump administration. Just give us the movie plot summary.
Yeah, this is in some ways a rerun of Trump's first season in the White House when he imposed 25% taxes on all imported steel and 10% taxes on imported aluminum. Some countries were eventually exempted from those tariffs, but imports from other countries are still subject to these taxes, and now Trump wants to extend them. But, you know, this could backfire. Recall, Trump says he got elected in part because Americans were fed up with the high cost of groceries. These tariffs won't help with that. In fact, they'll do the opposite, says Robert Budway, who's president of the Can Manufacturers Institute.
The tariffs will definitely increase inflation on the price of canned foods, and the consumer will feel it and see it.
You know, a tariff that drives up the cost of a can of soup or green beans or a six-pack of soda pop is not likely to win any friends at the supermarket, where many people are already fed up with high prices.
So the most basic question, why impose these tariffs?
One reason might be to raise revenues to offset the cost of tax cuts. Another reason might be to prop up the domestic steel and aluminum industries. When tariffs were first imposed back in 2018, we did see a drop in the share of steel that was imported. Today, it's somewhere between 25% and 30%. We've also seen some consolidation in the steel industry, which has given U.S. steelmakers more power to raise prices. But, you know, while those price hikes might be good for the steel companies, economist Catherine Russ of UC Davis says they really weigh on the much larger universe of businesses that use steel and aluminum.
Increasing the cost of imported steel increases costs for U.S. manufacturers who use steel, and we've seen that that can have measurable impacts on their hiring. And it has measurable impacts on their ability to export.
Russ estimates that Trump's first round of steel and aluminum tariffs wound up costing the U.S. about 75,000 manufacturing jobs within the first 2 years.
Scott, what kind of reaction are you watching for if Trump does indeed follow through with these tariffs?
It's likely to be mixed. You know, I talked a couple months ago with Mark McClellan, who runs an aluminum business down in Texas that makes things like window frames and auto parts. He generally welcomes Trump's protectionist instincts because he's facing a lot of cheap foreign competition himself. But at the same time, he acknowledges the original aluminum tariffs made it more expensive to do business.
It drove up our raw material costs by 10%. Whether we imported them or not, even if it was domestically produced, it just raises your cost 10%.
And by taxing aluminum but not imported products made from aluminum, Trump could actually make it harder for McClellan to compete with foreign rivals.
NPR Scott Horsley, thanks.
You're welcome.
People who inherit one very rare gene mutation are almost guaranteed to develop Alzheimer's before they turn 50, except for Doug Whitney.
I'm 75 years old, and I think I'm functioning fairly well. I'm still not showing any of the symptoms of Alzheimer's.
NPR's John Hamilton reports on what scientists are learning from a man who is an exception to a genetic rule.
Early onset Alzheimer's is everywhere in Doug Whitney's family.
10 of my mother's 14 brothers and sisters had the Alzheimer's gene. None of them lasted past 60 years old.
Whitney's wife, Ione, saw this up close.
We went home for Thanksgiving, and his mom couldn't remember the pumpkin pie recipe. And a year later, when we went back, she was already wandering off and not finding her way back home.
She was in her 40s at the time. The affected family members all carried a mutated version of a gene called presenilin 2. The variant causes a person's brain to accumulate beta amyloid and tau proteins, the hallmarks of Alzheimer's. Doug Whitney assumed he didn't have the mutation when he was still fine at 60, but he wanted to help others, so he volunteered for a study of families with early Alzheimer's.
I submitted my blood samples, and to my great surprise, I came back positive for the Alzheimer's gene. It was quite a shock.
It was also a shock for scientists, including Jorge Gibre of Washington University in St. Louis. Gibre says Whitney is just the third person known to have dodged the effects of an early Alzheimer's mutation.
It's so important, right, because it's telling us that something is going on that is protecting these people.
The first two came from a group in Colombia with mutations to the presenilin 1 gene. Whitney is the only person known to have resisted a mutation in the presenilin 2 gene. Gibre says all three had lots of beta amyloid protein in their brains. But he says they didn't have much tau, the other Alzheimer's protein.
So one key element of the disease, that is having the tau protein spread through the brain, that was not happening.
Tau is a misfolded protein that tends to appear in one place, then spread. Gibre says in Whitney's brain, tau was confined to a small area involved in visual perception.
There is something that is protecting him from tau spreading.
Now, scientists are trying to figure out what. One thing they've learned is that Whitney's brain contained high levels of heat shock proteins, which help protect cells from high temperatures. Gibre says they also seem to prevent tau from misfolding into the toxic form associated with Alzheimer's.
It may be the case that those proteins are preventing more tau to be misfolded and then spread through the brain.
Gibre says the findings, which appear in the journal Nature Medicine, could point the way to new treatments for Alzheimer's.
The main point is that if we are able to learn what is causing the protection here, then we could translate that to therapeutic approaches and apply that to the more common forms of the disease.
Scientists told Doug Whitney that the high levels of heat shock proteins in his brain might be the result of his life experience.
I spent 20 years in the Navy, most of it in the hot spots like the engine rooms of ships. 110 degrees is nothing on a ship.
Whitney plans to continue making his brain available to scientists in hopes they will find a way to protect other brains from Alzheimer's.
I would love to see that happen while I'm still around.
And still thinking clearly. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes, to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. As Greenland looks ahead to parliamentary elections next month, it's also taking steps to stop other countries from interfering with its political future. Last week, it banned political contributions from foreign entities.
The ban marks one of the latest responses to the Trump administration's ambitions to acquire Greenland from Denmark. And those ambitions are not new. John Bolton was there during Trump's first term when talks about an acquisition came up in 2019. He served first as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, then as national security advisor. Trump fired Bolton that same year. They have not publicly agreed on much since.
But Bolton told our co-host, Juana Summers, why he does think there is still a case for American expansion into Greenland.
Greenland has been important to the United States for a long time. There's a long history here. And right now, we're concerned about Chinese and Russian efforts in the Arctic Ocean and the transit routes out of the Arctic Ocean, particularly into the North Atlantic, to undermine our strategic position. We're concerned about some quite likely very valuable mineral rights and other aspects of Greenland that really are important to the security of Canada, the United States, the entire NATO alliance. And I think these are the sorts of issues that we really need to focus on. There's a lot of distraction in the atmosphere about Greenland and how to deal with it, but these are national security issues of critical importance to us and to our NATO allies as well.
Obviously, a possible acquisition of Greenland is a sensitive topic for many. You've talked in the past about President Trump's plans to negotiate with Denmark to buy Greenland during his first term, and you've said that he effectively blew up any possibility of that happening by airing those plans publicly before privately raising them with Danish leaders. So to achieve the kinds of strategic security goals that exist in the region now, what kind of path forward do you think there is?
Well, I'd be happy if everybody started to just put it behind them and not discuss it publicly. It's obviously sensitive both for the government of Denmark and for the local government in Greenland. And by making outrageous statements, including refusing to rule out the use of force, Trump is getting in his own way. He's making it harder to reach a solution that everybody might agree on, because in a democratic society, when you act like you're a playground bully, you put other democratic leaders in a difficult position. You're driving them into a corner. It's making it much harder for them to think about ways that we can find something that's mutually acceptable. So this was true in 2019, and you know, we've lost almost 6 years, and he's come close to doing it again. I think reasonable people can put it back together, but all of this discussion has been a waste of time.
So Greenland, as you know, would have to, in all likelihood, vote for independence from Denmark first in order to become a U.S. territory. And as you know, Greenland's prime minister has repeatedly said Greenlanders do not want to be Danish and they don't want to be American either. So I'd like to ask you, Ambassador, in your diplomatic expertise, how could the U.S. best make the case to Greenlandic citizens and leaders who clearly have strong feelings about their own autonomy, their own independence?
Well, there are arrangements, even with U.S. sovereignty, that would give them considerable independence in all local matters. They could become a commonwealth of the United States, like Puerto Rico is. And beyond that, there are other things that exist, like the 1951 Defense of Greenland Treaty, which is a bilateral treaty between the U.S. and Denmark. We could work on that, even if Greenland became independent. I certainly hope they would be a NATO member if they decided on that. It's hard to talk about all of these publicly with so much at stake, but there are a range of options. And I do think if we could just get back on an even keel here and stop thinking about Trump casinos in the capital of Greenland, Nuuk on the beach, it would be a lot easier to get things accomplished.
You mentioned the casino, so I do want to ask you about that. You've mentioned that Trump wants to potentially put a casino in Greenland's capital. I know back in 2019, he posted a tweet that promised not to put up a Trump property there. To your own knowledge, has he said on record that he might want to put a casino in Nuuk?
Well, it was just a sort of juvenile thing that to put out a picture of a casino there and say, but I'm not going to do it. I don't think it was well received in Greenland. Let's put it that way. And this is a very serious matter. It's another indication on issues that have enormous national security implications. Trump doesn't see the gravity of what he's dealing with and the harm that can be caused by these kinds of playground level statements.
Regardless of what we can tell about the president's motivations, a lot of people who are watching him in his first few weeks in office think that the current rhetoric on Greenland, when you take it alongside what he has had to say about Canada or the Panama Canal, as well as Gaza, that it signals a shift to a new era of American imperialism in trying to take over other sovereign places. So I'm curious what you would say to that part of the discourse and whether you think that concerns about security should outweigh concerns about independence and colonialism.
Well, I think the U.S. is about the least imperialist major power in human history. I think our record is not entirely clear on that, but is much different from almost every other great power over the course of recorded history. And I think that to say that Trump has created a new doctrine or he has a new policy is the most inaccurate thing of all, because Trump doesn't have a philosophy. He doesn't have a national security grand strategy. He doesn't do policy in the way we conventionally understand that. And so I think all of these things, although he mentioned them at one point all in one statement, do not form a coherent strategy. And in fact, simply the way he presents them makes it more difficult for him and the United States to achieve the objectives that he says he wants. You know, people say, well, that's the way he negotiates in business. And I just ask most business people, do you, with respect to your customers and suppliers, do you slap them around publicly frequently? Does that help your business or hurt it? Trump doesn't seem to get the point there.
Ambassador Bolton, if a purchase of Greenland does not come to pass, what other moves do you want to see the Trump administration make to address all of these concerns around security and the economy in the Arctic that we've been discussing?
Well, I think it would be good to have a strategy that the United States could apply to dealing with these threats in the Arctic. I can tell you that the Russians have spent decades thinking about this. They're far ahead of us. And the Chinese, who aspire to become an Arctic power, which we should recognize what they're doing, I think are also way ahead of us. Now, strategic thinking is not Donald Trump's strength, but he's got a cabinet that can do it. And I think we need to do it sooner rather than later. And I think, and we discussed this a little bit during Trump's first term, how we involve other Arctic powers, which are all now NATO members, that Finland and Sweden have joined NATO. So we've got a forum to do it, and we shouldn't lose any time.
We've been speaking with John Bolton, former National Security Advisor and former United States Ambassador to the UN. Ambassador Bolton, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And a note, NPR reached out to the White House in response to Bolton's remarks. National Security Council spokesperson Brian Hughes wrote, in part, quote, President Trump's America First policy is already paying dividends, especially in the Western Hemisphere. We're sorry John Bolton can't comprehend the president's many successes in just 3 weeks, end quote. He also cited the president's moves on illegal immigration, drug interdiction, and trade in Panama among those successes.
Our co-host Juana Summers will have more reporting on the perspectives from Greenlanders from the ground later this month.
Yes, she will. This is NPR News.
Finding love in the age of dating apps can be hard.
The app culture is next, and that can really feel like it's cheapening the entire experience.
So that's probably why matchmaking shows like Jewish Matchmaking and Indian Matchmaking have struck a chord. Now there's a new one for Muslims in America. Meet the hosts tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. These early weeks of the Trump administration are drastically changing the face of science in the U.S.
This change will break our universities, our medical centers, and the entire engine for scientific discovery.
New rules for funding science research after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump is imposing a 25% tariff on steel and aluminum imports from all countries by ending Biden-era exclusions for certain favored nations. Trump says the U.S. will also institute new standards for steel and aluminum in North America, designed to prevent countries like China and Russia from sending their steel to Mexico and Canada, where they are then relabeled as being from those countries. The moves could raise costs for businesses and consumers that buy steel and aluminum. A federal judge is extending a pause on the Trump administration's fork-in-the-road resignation offer to federal employees. As Walter Wuthman of member station WBUR reports, some 2 million civilian workers had faced a midnight deadline to decide whether to resign or keep their jobs and risk future termination.
A group of unions representing thousands of federal workers say the offer is unlawful and aims to replace career civil servants with people ideologically aligned with Trump. Government attorneys reject those claims and say the unions lack standing to challenge an administrative action. Union attorney Elena Goldstein praised the extension.
We hope that this decision today will provide civil service workers with the assurance that the American people have their backs. And we will continue to pursue all legal options to ensure that they are protected and that the law is upheld.
Federal Judge George O'Toole did not indicate when he will issue a final ruling. For NPR News, I'm Walter Wuthman in Boston.
President Trump ordered the U.S. Mint to stop making new pennies, which cost more than 3 cents each to produce. The Mint says it lost $85.3 million in the 2024 fiscal year on more than 3 billion pennies it produced. It's also an idea that's been floated by members of both parties for years. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Trump administration is raising the pressure on local law enforcement to help the federal government with immigration enforcement. As NPR's Martin Costi reports, the response so far has followed party lines.
Florida says its highway patrol will help identify and hold people who are wanted for deportation, and other Republican-led states are encouraging similar cooperation. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is pausing grants to Democratic-run jurisdictions with sanctuary laws. University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris predicts there will be some increase in cooperation by local law enforcement.
The places you're going to see it, I would anticipate, would be sheriff's departments. That's because sheriffs are elected, and if you've got a constituency that favors this, you're going to look for ways to do what your constituents want.
Courts have found that the federal government may not order local police to help, but the Justice Department is now suing Chicago for, quote, impeding federal immigration enforcement. Martin Costi, NPR News.
President Trump signed an executive order today reversing a federal push away from plastic straws, saying that paper straws don't work. Trump has long railed against paper straws, and he sold Trump-branded reusable plastic straws in his 2019 reelection campaign. The Biden administration in several states and cities banned plastic straws because they pollute oceans and waterways and harm marine life. U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station.
And from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Universities and other institutions doing medical research could lose out on billions of dollars of federal funding. That's after the Trump administration changed a key rule in the way the National Institutes of Health allocates grants. And it's just one of several recent moves to control funding for science research. NPR science correspondent John Lambert and NPR health correspondent Rob Stein spoke to my colleague Mary Louise Kelly.
Rob, you kick us off. I want to understand this new NIH policy. This has to do with funding medical research at universities, at med schools, research hospitals. What exactly is new?
So late on Friday, the NIH announced a huge change in how the world's largest public funder of biomedical research pays to find new cures for everything from cancer and heart disease to diabetes. The NIH is capping how much the agency pays for what's called indirect costs at 15%, and that's far lower than what the NIH had been paying. There's a big range, but the administration says it can exceed 50 or 60% at some universities. Indirect costs cover things that are essential for doing medical research, like, you know, paying to maintain buildings and literally paying for the electricity to keep the lights on in labs. And I think it's fair to say that it hit like a bomb when it was announced, especially because it was announced late on a Friday and went into effect the next business day, today. Let's listen to Jo Handelsman. She runs the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Cutting the rate to 15% will destroy science in the United States. This change will break our universities, our medical centers, and the entire engine for scientific discovery.
Destroying science. She is not mincing words there. Does everyone agree with that assessment, Rob?
Well, that's certainly the overwhelming sentiment of most of the folks involved in medical research that I've been talking to, as well as many Democrats in Congress and even some Republicans. But there certainly are others who disagree and agree with the president that the federal government is just paying too much for these indirect costs, especially because many universities have huge endowments and private foundations pay far less. Here's Carl Schramm. He's an economist at Syracuse University who studies scientific funding.
The university endowments have grown so enormously, I think the federal government is basically saying, why don't you put some of your skin in this game?
And, you know, I've talked to some who've argued that this could force universities to cut some of the bloat in their bureaucracies and maybe even end up providing more money for actual research. In fiscal year 2023, $9 billion of the $35 billion the NIH spent on research grants went to indirect costs.
I want to broaden this out a little bit because there are also changes to science funding beyond NIH. John, get us up to speed. What is going on at the National Science Foundation?
It's been a tumultuous few weeks at the agency. The biggest moves have been Trump's executive orders targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion measures across the government. And these really hit hard at the heart of NSF's mission. Since the 1990s, Congress has mandated that they weigh grants in part on their intellectual merits and in part on how they will broaden the participation of underrepresented groups in science.
Since the 90s, and why was that?
Basically, there's a lot of evidence that this helps science work better and ultimately gives the taxpayer more bang for their buck. But the Trump administration is essentially saying that they can't do that. And this is building off longstanding criticisms from the right. Senator Ted Cruz, for instance, has long railed against the NSF, saying that they fund research that promotes, quote, neo-Marxist perspectives that he says detract from so-called hard science. And for now, it seems like the NSF is siding with the Trump administration over their mandate from Congress. It's actually using a list of DEI keywords authored by Cruz to evaluate all of their grants for compliance.
Well, and speak to that, because is this just about DEI, or is there a bigger picture unfolding at the NSF?
Yeah, there's a bigger picture. So staff last week were told to expect layoffs of 25 to 50% over the next 2 months, and they're also expecting that President Trump's proposed budget could cut funding by billions of dollars for the agency. And these kinds of reductions would just be devastating for their research capacity and for research as a whole in the U.S. I spoke with Elizabeth Pop Berman, a sociologist at the University of Michigan, about what all these actions might mean.
The fundamental thing that's happening, I think, is taking control of science away from people who are doing science and people who are in that space and giving it to political figures.
So practically speaking, internationally speaking, what could this mean for science, for scientific research? I want both of you to take that. John, you first.
Yeah, overall, the U.S. may just start spending significantly less on research. And that could mean that there are potentially lots of discoveries that just don't get made or could be made elsewhere.
Yeah, and I'd say there's a similar sentiment in the world of biomedical research. A lot of concern that this could undermine the U.S.'s standing in biomedical research globally. But I should also note that just today, a coalition of 22 attorneys general announced they'd filed a lawsuit in Massachusetts to block the sudden changes in the NIH's funding policy for indirect costs. And a federal judge granted a temporary restraining order prohibiting the federal government from imposing the cap in those states, pending a hearing later this month.
We will see where that one goes. NPR's Rob Stein and John Lambert, thank you.
Thank you.
You bet.
The fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas has allowed desperately needed food and medicine to enter Gaza. The country of Jordan has started a test program to send military helicopters carrying medical aid into Gaza. NPR's Jane Araf joined the Jordanian military on one of those flights.
At the King Abdullah II Air Base outside of Amman, helicopter crews are on the tarmac, loading supplies in what has been a test run for getting more aid into Gaza.
They're loading up cardboard boxes into the hold of this Black Hawk helicopter, big Jordanian flags on them. They're carrying medical aid and things like infant formula.
Jordan has been conducting airdrops into Gaza for more than a year. But those were pallets with parachutes pushed out of cargo planes, and they didn't always land where they were supposed to. These flights, 16 a day for 8 days, are exploring whether landing the aircraft in Gaza and handing supplies over on the ground is a better option. We climb in, sitting on cardboard boxes of medical supplies. Cleared for takeoff, the pilot lifts off for the two-hour flight, part of it along the Dead Sea that separates Jordan from Israel. In Israel, we fly over communities with swimming pools, green farm fields, and then crossing into Gaza, there's almost no color.
We've just landed in Gaza, not very far into Gaza, just a few hundred feet beyond the fence. It's part of the buffer zone that Israel has created. There is not another person in sight here, but just down the road we can see trucks that are presumably waiting to load up with these supplies.
It's a very rare glimpse of Gaza on the ground. Local journalists have covered the war at great risk since it began, but Israel, for the most part, bans foreign journalists from here. It takes less than 5 minutes to unload. Not the easiest or cost-effective way to bring in aid, but with so much need here, Jordan says, still a necessary one. Jane Araf, NPR News, near Deir al-Balah, Gaza.
You're listening to All Things Considered. For a lot of people currently living through winter in Minnesota, hockey is life. Now, if you did not grow up playing the sport, it can be intimidating to learn as an adult. Hence, this one hockey club for beginner women called, actually, I'm going to have Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker tell you all about it.
Okay, listen close, because the name of this team is appropriate for public radio.
Let's go!
That's right, the Mother Puckers. Yes, with a P. There are a handful of like-minded clubs that share the name across the country. This one is based in Duluth. At a recent scrimmage at an outdoor neighborhood rink, the temperature was in the single digits, but Julie Floaten barely noticed.
I don't even pay attention to the cold. It's just like being a kid again, because you're just playing.
Floaten is 54. She's an oncology nurse in Duluth. She skated a little bit as a kid, but never played hockey. Then last year, she found the mother puckers.
Everyone's so welcoming, right? So, and it feels like it's rare to have a community like that as adults. People willing to learn something new and be silly and be vulnerable.
Some more experienced players fly across the ice, but others are still wobbly on their skates.
Whoa.
And then two players collide and crash to the ice. They get to their knees, make sure they're okay, and then hug each other, laughing. One of them, Deanna Nataro, proudly shows off her jersey.
This is jersey number 53 because I started hockey when I was 53 years old.
This is only Nataro's fourth practice.
I'm what Mother Puckers was made for. I have a lot to work on, but it makes it challenging and fun, and I have a lot of good mentors around me.
One of whom is Kimberly Rhines, also 53.
Nobody says, you know, that you shouldn't be here or that you're not good enough. And at my age, that doesn't happen very often, where you can kind of start something from scratch, never having done it before, and still feel like you belong.
Rhines and many others are truly mothers. Many have kids who play hockey and wanted to learn the game themselves. 42-year-old Lisa Klein started the Duluth team a couple years ago after learning to play at a Mother Puckers club outside Chicago. There are professors and designers, firefighters and hairstylists. 60 members play once a week outdoors just among themselves.
I love that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Like, I can fall down and I can fail and I can get back up and it's not important. It's just pure joy. So much laughing. I think I laugh more here than at any other space in my life.
After practice, Stuart Getty lingers on the ice to cool off. They learned about the Mother Puckers in an article that said the team was open to anyone who wanted to play women's hockey.
And I use they, them pronouns. I'm non-binary. And so I reached out to them and said, I'd love to learn how to play hockey. What do you guys think? And they were like, heck yeah, we said welcome to all, so come on down. Because, like, I look real gay. And I came from California, and I was like, oh, God, they're going to hate me. And they have been amazingly inclusive.
Getty, who's 43, says a lot of their teammates wanted to play hockey when they were younger. But many were told girls couldn't play. For some who did, it got so competitive it wasn't fun anymore.
There's just, like, all these stories of people where hockey said no to them, and this team says yes.
Which kind of sums up the Mother Puckers. They support one another while challenging themselves to do something really hard. And they have a lot of fun doing it. For NPR News, I'm Dan Crocker in Duluth.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Skin whitening is a major industry around the world, including in the U.S., but it is endemic in Nigeria, Africa's most populous country. It's rooted in colonial-era beauty standards that see brighter skin tones as more desirable. The effects can be severe, and many people who use these products are unable to stop, as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports.
I went through hell before I got myself again.
Susan Anderson is a 52-year-old store assistant.
I was helpless.
We met in the waiting room of a dermatology clinic in the capital, Abuja. Parts of her face looked seared with burns. Thick dark patches of skin surrounded her eyes and covered her cheeks. Anderson started using skin whitening creams as a child, given to her by her stepmother.
I think at the age of 12, she never explained to me. I just felt it was a normal cream and I was using them. I was naive and I was vulnerable.
When she was 15, a school friend recommended a stronger product used as a body lotion.
Within 1 week, I started seeing changes. I started becoming more fairer than I was.
And how did it make you feel?
I felt happy. I felt I was looking more beautiful.
Until it nearly killed her when she became pregnant.
It was during delivery I had a terrible cut.
She had a vaginal tear that doctors struggled to treat because the whitening creams had eroded layers of her skin.
They sewed it, but the stitches were not holding. I almost died at that point.
And it took over a year for her to recover. Skin whitening or skin bleaching is a major industry around the world, but especially in Nigeria. More than 77% of Nigerian women have used skin whitening products, according to the UN, the highest rate in Africa. One of the major markets in the country is the populous northern city of Kano. At the Sabongeri market are several small stores covered in posters and images of white and Arab women, which sell an array of skin whitening products. Mirror White's whitening lotion, Skin Beauty White, So White, So Beautiful. Quick action, rapid white. One of the store owners is 29-year-old Shafari Mansour.
Some person, they say they want bath salts. Some people, they say they want shower gel. Anyone you want, we can do it for you.
He says most customers are interested in whitening creams and soaps, but some want other types of products too.
Injection, like this one.
He shows me a box of small clear capsules of hyaluronic acid like and hexapeptide used for injection. He says he doesn't administer them himself.
But me, I'm not doing it. It's not good.
Instead, he says, he uses the serums to mix bespoke creams and soaps for customers. Traders like Shafari mix a cocktail of various whitening products with self-made solutions, stirring them in plastic bowls in their stores. But there's a catch with all whitening products, he says. They only work if you keep using them.
If you stop using it, you turn back to your black. God created you black. Who can change you? Nobody.
He said God created you black, and no one can change it. So when you stop, your skin reverts back within weeks, but with damage.
People that bleach their skin is like an addiction.
Zainab Bashir is Susan Anderson's doctor in Abuja. She founded Derma RX, a dermatology clinic. She said there is very little regulation of skin whitening products.
Anyone can literally walk into a pharmacy, buy it without any prescription, and use it for as long as they want.
The products have been linked to higher rates of skin cancer, and Nigeria's government said it was considering new regulations on skin whitening products. After her medical scare, Susan Anderson briefly stopped using the whitening creams, but then she started again.
It was actually very, very hard for me to stop using them.
And continued for decades, while battling severe reactions and burns. She felt more and more isolated as the side effects worsened.
I couldn't get a job. And I also lost a man whom I was dating that I was supposed to get married to because he said he cannot present me to his family.
She eventually found work as a store assistant. And during one of her shifts last year, she met Zainab Bashir, who brought Anderson to her clinic.
She said, I shouldn't worry that she's going to help me out. And I was.
After losing hope, she finally found the help she needed. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Abuja and Kano.
Ariana Grande has been in the news lately for a bunch of reasons, for her Oscar nomination for Wicked, for her potential collaboration with Billie Eilish, and for changing her voice when she speaks. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports that this last one keeps coming up.
People have been baffled by Ariana Grande's habit of changing her voice during public appearances for years. Last summer, for instance, in an interview for the Podcrushed podcast, her vocal register switched from this...
I was like, what has happened?
..to this.
Yeah, I've been writing a lot.
And attracted thousands of online comments.
I would like to do a deluxe at some point.
The artist has repeatedly said in interviews and on social media she often modulates her voice for health reasons.
If I have a long day of press or if I have to sing, I'll place it a little higher.
Because staying higher gives less stress on it than talking in a lower register?
Yes.
This is Grande's latest attempt to explain herself. It's from an interview she gave on the Smartless podcast. Comments about her changing voice have recently bubbled up again in her media appearances for Wicked.
And it's so funny because we've talked about it a zillion times and people are still like, where's your real voice? And I'm like, well, they all are.
All of these voices are her natural voice.
Sarah Schneider is a voice speech pathologist at the University of California, San Francisco. Schneider says the voices of famous women, Paris Hilton, Kamala Harris, tend to come under more scrutiny than those of famous men. Also, most people simply have a blind spot when it comes to the workings of the voice.
The average person who is not using their voice for their profession takes their voice for granted. They don't realize that our instrument is inside of our body and the things that we do with our body impact what we can do with our voice, right?
Schneider says it's common for athletic vocal performers with demanding schedules to place their voices differently on busy days.
To help with stamina, to help with endurance, to help with voice preservation.
And the voice speech pathologist says the vocal shifts performers make are often more subtle than Grande's. Artists adapt their voices in different ways to maintain their vocal health.
For other people, it's how they're using their airflow and their resonance, their breath, and how they're like modulating the energy of their voice.
Speaking higher isn't a universal solution. Schneider says Ariana Grande pitches her voice up because that specifically helps her. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the John D. and Catherine